Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Poetry Show, broadcast on Wednesday at the new time now, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, on www.enlightenradio.org. And the player is usually, well, typically located at the top of that page, but sometimes if you're on a phone, for some reason, my website gets, the top of it gets clipped off on your phone. So if you want to make sure, you just go to the player, you go to player.enlightenradio.org. And so whenever my system is not crashed, it should be playing. and the Poetry Show is hosted, of course, by my good friend and longtime partner at various incarnations of this program, Janet Harrison. And it's been a great education for me to read poetry, with her, and mostly poems that she suggests. And I was an English major way back, but I spent about 20 years writing leaflets instead of poems, and that it ruined my some things about my. I was a union representative for a long time. Anyway, so I want to welcome Michael Jackman to the show, but I'm going to ask Janet to introduce her here, and take it away, Janet.
Hey, I met Michael when I was doing my master's in fine arts at the Naslin Mann School of Writing, Graduate School of Writing. It's been renamed. It had been Spalding University's MFA program. And Michael Jackman, my dear friend, has published poetry, fiction, nonfiction, feature journalism, and scholarship. For 17 years before his retirement, he taught on the writing faculty at Indiana University Southeast. Jackman earned an MFA in poetry from Spalding University's Low Residency Program and an MA in fiction and literature from the University of Louisville. He's a songwriter as well as a poet, and we should hear one of his songs during this show, and sings and performs acoustic guitar, lead guitar, dobro, ukulele, lap steel, and flute. Currently, he's a member of the Louisville bass band, Crazy Chester. Along with his wife and son, he's a micro homesteader, working a tad less than 2 acres in New Albany, Indiana, across the Ohio River from Louisville, Kentucky, keeping a native plant meadow, organic garden beds, a butterfly and pollinator garden, and egg-laying chickens, whom I've met. He's published in many places, including Louisville Review, Nebo New Writing, International Journey for the Practice and Theory of Creative Writing, and many others. And we're so happy that he was able to join us in person today. And Michael, welcome. It's good to see your face.
Thank you. It's good to see yours, too. And thank you, John, as well. Yeah, we haven't seen each other in person for a while, but it is wonderful to see you.
I got to ask you a question. I had Crazy Chester. Is that, any connection to Take a Load Off Fanny?
Yes, that's the way it is. is our that's the song that gave us the name of the band.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
His first. Yes, John?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, the first poem, we're reading from his newly published chapbook, Letters from Spickert Knob. And the first poem is Letter 9. Michael, do you want to read?
Sure. Okay, so this this book is, I guess, epistolary in the sense that it's all poetry, but it's also written as if they were letters, letters to my now spouse, Sarah. Letter 9. Gradually, we're losing control of the house. The kitchen floor is rotting under the tiles where water seeps through a crack by the sink. Morning glory vines stretch across the back patio, pulling up bits of concrete. Where birds gather, we discover mulberry saplings in the flower beds, so carefully tilled and bordered and planted with bulbs that first year. Maples spring up in the meadow. The previous spring, their seeds gently whirled in from faraway trees. A foundation block, exhausted from supporting the west facade, cracks diagonally. Its neighbors groan. Beaten by the sun, double-paned windows surrender their gases. Their insides turn speckled and brown. We can hear the homestead inhaling, exhaling, creaking in many new ways throughout the year. Even the ground heaves. Over time, the house shifts, twists, sheds a piece or two of itself. Nails pull out of their holes. A warped rail pops off the front deck gate and falls into the forsythia bush. Will it become too much for us? The truth of it frightens me, that everything built becomes unbuilt.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
I think the strength of this poem is the tremendous accumulation of concrete detail. And I love the maple saplings whirling in from far away.
Thank you. You know, this book is, well, basically when Sarah and I and her son Theodore came to be in this place and do a homestead, it was pretty intense. We decided to do all these things, and they just naturally, they live in my mind, all the intensity. And so the book follows a lot of the process of putting it together and it falling apart, you know, and as well, I guess, the putting together, the repairing of relationship. So this is the context for something like that.
Well, there's both entropy and reverse entropy.
Definitely. There's a lot of entropy on the homestead.
But, yes, right.
You put something together, and over the years, it crumbles.
So life is a struggle against forces of entropy, you know. Or on the other hand, you know, you could say that your building is just a relic, right, or your house. And nature is retaking it, you know, constantly, which might be its own reverse entropy of some sort. But
do that.
Well, but you can. The details are so concrete; you can really visualize what's going on. And anyone who's lived in an old house can identify with this poem, I think.
Well, I appreciate that. I try to keep a common language, you know, not in this book, and not be too intellectual, and keep it concrete, as you say, you know, visceral in terms of the surroundings.
It's very spare. The language is not complex, but it's very vivid.
Thank you.
Do you still live there?
Oh, yeah. We're still here.
Uh-huh.
We've had a big crop this year, and we've been canning and canning and canning, for instance, tomato products. And,
we lived in a house. Matter of fact, my son still lives in it. We sort of started to call it the upside down house, and you know, Carol kept envisioning us falling down every time we answered the front door or basically got out of bed, and so we moved into all on one floor, and so a lot of the repairables are not threats the way they were once before, you know. Anyway, so I may carry that poem with me now, you know, just to mark, you know, the decay.
It was a shock to realize that when you build things, they do begin to fall into disrepair, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's read letter 14, which is kind of an antidote to letter 9.
It is. It is an anodyne, an antidote to letter 9. It was the opposite hopeful discovery, which applies to homesteads as well as relationships. Letter 14. The repaired gate is sturdy if still lopsided. The re-rooted corkscrew willow cutting is growing slender, new green fingers. Who cares if some double-paned windows are foggy? Persimmons fall in August and are preserved. In winter, I remove the old nest from the bluebird house. In spring, another appears. It comforts me to know that if everything built becomes unbuilt, some things can be built again.
That poem almost, you know, and the two will end with, almost have remind me of Chinese poetry. It's observational, very clear, very very well stated, and comes down to a real punch at the end. If everything built becomes unbuilt, some things can be built again.
You know, during the process of living here, coincidentally, you mentioned that I've been reading a lot of the Tao, different translations, and the idea of unbeing and being and nothingness and creativity and yin and yang. You know, I don't want to sound too like Crystal Heady or anything, but it has influenced me, and it has influenced the way I think about poetry and also the things that happen in nature. So there, you know, you say there's a little like Chinese poetry, and that's a little like what the Tao is. So thank you for that connection.
And who does care if the double paned windows are foggy?
I think Sarah cares. I think she wants me to replace them, which it's not high on the list right now. I've got to repair the door sill. That's coming pretty high, but anyway, yeah. Who really does? That's true.
Right.
Thank you.
John, do you have anything you want to say?
No, I mean, I think that the it's anything that can be built or unbuilt can be rebuilt. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm going to, that one's going to tumble around in my brain for now, another 3 or 4 days at least. Okay. About as I think about that. And since everything's it's kind of in motion, I mean, you know, there's always things going away and new things coming into being that, you know, the stuff that's in the rear view mirror, the unbuilt stuff, you know, and now you have, but you don't always build the same thing again. And if you build the same thing, you know, some new generation builds it with a different combination of hands. And so it doesn't get built the same way. It's like produce and then there's reproduction, you know,
I like your observation that it doesn't get built the same way. And, in some ways it's never as perfect as the original, you know. I consider this book a love letter, not just a love letter to my family and to nature, but sort of a love letter to the world. So I appreciate all the comments and how you tease out all the different structures and images.
Okay, John, do you want to queue up Michael's song 50-50? And then we can talk a little bit about the difference between writing poems and writing songs.
Okay, here it comes.
One of my most argumentative subjects with my students. So great.
I'd be in a position tonight to listen to a treat, so here sit back and enjoy it. Here is Michael Jackman.
Thanks. Well, I'm going to start with three tunes by myself, a couple that I wrote, and then I'm going to add some of my comrades and friends from my band Crazy Chester to help me out, and we'll we'll announce them as they come in.
From a radio.
But they're standing by. This first song is called 50-50. I'm kind of proud of this one because I had set out to write a song where the hook, the little trope 50-50 appears everywhere in the song, and it kind of, well, it worked out well for me, and I hope you enjoy it too. Grandpa never complained about getting old, just said it beats the alternative. That's how he used to explain that halfway was the way to live. I'm half as old as he was then, and I respectfully disagree. Living halfway out and halfway in is no alternative for me. And I'm tired of living 50-50. As good as half the time might be. A life that's not half bad is not the life for me. I found me a brand new place. The move seems like a bold one. A halfway house where I might erase my state of mind from the old one. Brown shag carpet, wall to wall, don't even have half my stuff. Would not say I'm having a ball, but halfway to a new life is enough. And I'm tired of living 50-50. As good as half the time might be. A life that's not half bad is not life for me. And I'm of living 50-50. As good as half the time might be. A life that's not half bad is not the life.
Wow, nice song. Very nice.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You know, but circumstances might make someone take a different view of 50-50. Like if you've been living, you know, most of your time at 10.
I guess then 50 is a step
finally
up.
You finally make it to 50-50.
Don't live most of your time at 10. If you, you know, if you do, well, I life is, you know, the song makes a general point that for sure there are things that it can't possibly cover. Yeah.
I just, maybe it's all
I think it's a challenge. You know, just stop living part way. You know, stop dipping your foot in the water and then pulling back and saying, okay, it was wet.
It is a challenge. And, you know, I suppose what the song doesn't go into is that, well, when you make changes, they're not easy. And they also tend to upset things like other people and families.
Yeah, exactly.
And friends and spouses. So, you know, but that's fortunately we have options, and whatever they are, you know, I guess this is a call to action, to not be content with whatever it is.
It reminds me of some of my wife's ancestors, some of whom, you know, were possessed by Protestant zeal and became missionaries. And so an expression that was passed down, which acquired all kinds of meanings in the 60s, you know, was, that when you're on a mission, the mission comes first. And
well, to me, you know, 50-50, it's a common phrase, but whether it's 60-40 or 70-30 or 10-90, you know, I hope it still applies.
Well, if you're at 50-50.
But that's one of my favorite songs, so thank you for playing it.
I like it. I mean, when you're at 50-50, it's, you know, you're not necessarily, you know, no one's moving in the direction they want to go, you know, particularly. So
it's a tipping point.
Yeah, it's a tipping point. Very good.
But I had a question about the songwriting and poetry, you know, and of course, ever since, you know, Bob Dylan won a Nobel Prize for Literature, this has become somebody's crossed a border here at some point. A lot of people, maybe. Is song how we hear the poetic voice these days more? And if so, any thoughts about why? Is it just new tools? I don't know.
Well, you know, I don't want to make any overarching statements, but definitely song is an embedded part of popular culture. It's inescapable, and it's connected with media. Song is everywhere on every cable show. The soundtrack is often, you know, popular songs or independent songs done by artists. It's streamed, it's listened to in cars, on car rides. It's an inescapable fabric of life from birth until death. It's they're played at funerals, they're performed at weddings, you know. So yes, song and song lyrics, for the most, you know, I would argue they are poetry. There are differences, but it is the poetic voice. You know, that said, while songs cover a lot of territory, they in general can't cover the territory that poems can cover.
There's
many good reasons for that, the most clear of which is that the word popular. Songs are written to be heard most often by a popular audience, whether they're in musicals or in media. And as such, they have restraints then, you know, restraints on subject matter, or they just have genre focus that can be in a different direction than a poem can. So that's one key difference. But there are tons of differences technically between songs and poetry, and if you're interested in the quick overview of what some of them are, I'm happy to talk about that, because I love debating this with my students.
Yeah, well, the one that occurs to me is Yeats' Second Coming, and I think Joni Mitchell put it to song. Well, about 90% of it to a song. And she did a good job. I mean, a hard thing to do, and very ambitious. And but you know, when I hear the poem read, I still get a tingling up and down my spine.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. And just an edge of something terrible, wonderful, terrible, you know, something. And which the song, which Joni does a good job with, okay? You know, a more romantic feeling, okay? No, somehow, you know, that not quite... It does miss something, you know, that can't be captured.
Yeah, I suppose.
Anyway,
that's true. Thought. But we're talking about, rather than setting a poem to music, you know, composing a song as a song and composing a poem as a poem, there are certainly some key differences. The chief of which, that when you're writing songs, you are writing for the stage. I mean, you know you're writing for the stage. You know that you're writing a performance piece. And when you're writing a poem, with exceptions, because there's an exception to everything, like performance poetry, you're writing for the page. The poem tends to be a standalone performance. The voice you hear is often your own, in your head or read aloud, whereas the song is performed for you by a singer. And, you know, that's a key difference. Poetry is often written in free verse, but those who write formally, it's written in many forms. Songs usually have to conform to musical conventions. And in America, popular music, that convention would be like the 8-bar musical phrase that's repeated. One rising phrase, one falling phrase, melodically. Usually 4 of those per verse, plus you have a chorus. So your lyric line has to be written either after the music or before the music to sort of fit the standard construction of music in that. A couple of other things that I'll mention. I don't want to go on too long. I love the subject, though, and if anybody wants to write me and talk about it more. In poetry, you know, we say the image is paramount. But in a song, you have music. And music conveys emotion, whereas in poetry, the image conveys emotion. So you can relax a little bit. You don't have to. Songs like John Prine, Joni Mitchell, are rife with imagery, and it's wonderful. But it's actually the melody that can carry the emotions or even a counter emotion to what you're singing about. Like Sarah loves songs that are sad but have upbeat melodies. She has whole collections of these things, you know, which right. creates like kind of counterpoint. Songs use more techniques of repetition, hooks, if you're writing for a popular song. But I think more important, as far as the mechanics goes, you have to write for singers. You have to know how to write lines that open so that a singer can interpret it and give room. And, you know, usually this means the ends of phrases having words with open vowels, because you're dealing with an instrument. A singer uses the voice as one of the most finicky, but one of the most beautiful instruments ever created. But it is an instrument and it needs to be catered to. And songwriters do need to either instinctively sense or know how to write lines that can be sung with certain melodies, where you have to consider the vocal range that you're asking them to do, the kind of notes that you're asking them to do. So there's a lot that goes into it. And I guess I'll just close on the fact that songs are fundamentally collaborative. So in the end, either you have to be in yourself a musician and a lyricist, or you need two. And eventually there are going to be musicians and performers, people who sing harmony, choruses. There needs to be an arrangement, whereas, you know, the poem doesn't need that. So these are all things to consider when you're writing songs.
I think songs are a little bit looser, too. They're not quite as concentrated as most poems. Some people used to ask me in free verse what the difference between how can it be a poem if it doesn't rhyme, and what are the characteristics. And I always talked about what one of my teachers called the pounds per square inch, you know, right. How much impact you put into the phrasing.
Sure, sure.
I think poems are a little bit more concentrated usually,
unless you're Leonard Cohen.
Yes, that's true.
You know, I mean, that's the thing. There's a poet who puts poetry to music. Yeah, it is, you know, so, but you're right. They can be distilled, you know, in ways that songs often don't need to be or aren't, right? That's a good point. Finally, I guess songs can make money. but I don't know of any poets who have ever earned a living
writing poetry.
Right. Although I guess there's hope. I think we do it for the pure need to do it, I guess. But that's my spiel. And I'm not teaching anymore. I'm retired. So, but if anybody wants a class, they can contact me and I'll tell you all about it.
I thought the comments about songwriting and songs is really interesting. And I, there's a lot of aspiring young people that want to do it. And so that, you know, and probably underestimate, a number of things that you have to acquire knowledge about to and skill at to be able to, you know, to blend in the way you want it to sound. I think it'll be helpful. On poetry, should it, performance is how you sort of make your way, right, in the arts world now. I mean, you can't even sell albums anymore because, you know, the streaming has sort of undermined nearly everything in terms of intellectual property. So you see, you know, people having to do performance either virtually or directly. And that's a driving, just how to make a living at art, right? You have to go where there is money to a certain extent, right? And it's like the river, you know, you're in the river, you have to paddle.
Well, most musicians I know love to perform, but, you know, performing these days is not as lucrative as it used to be, especially since the pandemic. Costs have gone up. And it's very hard to render a profit. There's so many people you have to pay, so many expenses. As far as I know, I'm not a road musician, but I have some contact with people who are. But yeah, you know. But at least there's the potential. Well, Janet.
Anyway, okay.
And speaking of beautifully distilled verse, I want to end with two poems of Michael's, Letter 13. And letter 15, read them as a pair. Just pause between the two of them, and then we can talk about them together, because I think they match.
All right. And I also want to say what a pleasure it has been to be invited. And I thank you so much for having me, Janet, my poetry writing buddy, my alpha reader, you know, and John. Thank you for hosting me.
Wonderful.
Letter 13 is... okay, I'll just read letter 13. It's toward the conclusion, and then the final poem. Letter 13. One by one, the persimmons drop. There is no jealousy in the slow rain of fruit. The meaning of things, why the blue jay calls, what it feels, why this or that happened, why it feels like this or that, what is, was, will be done about it. In accord with each persimmon, hits a leafy ground, hits the leafy ground with a puck, and rolls to silence. And the final poem in the collection, letter 15. Dear Sarah, how the rain, any rain, and the sun too, sudden upon the, and the clouds sweeping like brooms, and how the light can be stones or feathers. All this, the rain, the clouds, the sun, and the light.
I don't know how these poems came to you, but they always come to me as gifts, like they just arrive, and they're so beautiful. And again, I feel a sense of Chinese writing underneath them. In letter 13, the line that really caught me was, there is no jealousy in the slow rain of fruit. I mean, you had me hooked there.
Thank you. It is a line that I debated whether I understood what I was writing. And then I decided
all right,
I was going to leave it in because I think it resonates in more ways than I understand. So I decided it was a good thing.
Well, the listener has the same reaction you did, you know, they don't know, but it makes you think about it because it does resonate, you know, so It was beautiful.
Thank you.
And How the Rain, you know, the line just startles me every time I read this poem, and I've read this poem probably 55 times, is how the light can be stones or feathers. That was such a surprising line. All this, the rain, the clouds, the sun, and the light. That's just such a stunning poem.
Be suitable.
Thank you.
Quaker
Go ahead, John.
Yes. Well, listen, you've been listening to The Poetry Show here on enlightenedradio.org, and this podcasts are usually up within a day or two, and you can always find our podcasts on podcasts.enlightenedradio.org. And in addition, the podcasts are also published really through podbean.com, and so if you visit our site there, it's called Democracy Road. podbean.com, and they're also posted there as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
To learn more about Michael, he has a website, michael-jackman.com, and the hyphen's very important. If you omit the hyphen, you get a visual artist. So Michael has more of his music and information about him up on his website.
All right.
Well, anything
else? Do we miss anything?
Well, thank you. I just wanted to say about Letter 15 that it was a poem that seems better than I can write. So, you know, I don't know where it came from in that case. Occasionally they pop out. Right. Other than that, no, but I hope you've enjoyed the podcast and the radio show, and we'll listen to the podcast, and I look forward to doing more things like this. Thank
you. All right. Okay, thanks so much, Michael. Right. Take care, everybody. It's late, but everything comes next.